You're going to turn to Genesis chapter 2. We'll be reading there in a couple minutes. Last week we talked about some basic principles for marriage. And this week I'm going to tread into even more murkier waters and talk about basic principles for training children. Not because I'm necessarily all that qualified. The more I go at it, the more I realize how unqualified I am. And there's certainly a lot more people here who's been at it a lot longer than me who could speak from a lot more experience. And again, it's one of those things where if I tell many of my experiences, they're not funny yet. I'm still recovering from most of the bad ones, mistakes. But I do have a new addition that just is rounding the six-month-old mark, which means he's transitioning into that dreadful period where you have to start correcting him. And so Mo had given me an article a year ago to read that I thought was kind of interesting. It was called Training Sessions. And at the moment didn't do a lot, you know, for me, but all of a sudden it's taken on a new interest. And so I read that again and thought the fellow made it some good points. So I'm going to work from an article that I had read. And I just have four points to make this morning that may be useful to you, and I hope that I can benefit from them too. It's amazing how much you forget over the last few years. And the first one I'm going to offer to you is called the tree principle. The tree principle. And this is back in Genesis chapter 2. So why don't you go back there, and we're going to read a verse or two in the Garden of Eden. I think it's very interesting where God placed these trees. Genesis chapter 2, verse 16 and 17. The Lord puts man in the garden, gives him a place to live and cultivate, and he says he commanded the man, saying, "From any tree of the garden you may eat freely, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. From the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die." We have this garden that God has made, and he puts man in the middle of it, gives him these assignments, and he puts this other tree in the garden, the tree of life, or the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And back up just a little bit from that verse to verse 9. He says, it's chapter 2, verse 9. It says, "Out of the ground the Lord caused to grow every tree that is pleasing for the sight and good for the food, and the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil." Gave him all these trees, but right in the center of the garden, right in the middle of it, he puts this tree of life, and he also puts a tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He doesn't put it on the edge of the garden, out on the fringes, or up in a mountain somewhere. Puts it right in the middle. And next to it, he puts a tree of life. So as Adam and Eve go in there, they're eating of the tree of life, the one that gives life. They also are made aware of the forbidden tree, that if they partake of it, it will cause them death. Now, I think it's kind of a training session that he was giving them. If they would learn to respect God's word and his authority in leaving that tree alone, it would prepare them for a lot more serious temptations that they would encounter over their lifetime. You know, Adam lived 900 years. That wasn't the only temptation he had. And what God tried to do was to train them to say no to themselves. Yes, you can eat this tree here and you can reap this tree of life and all these other trees, but this one you don't eat. So no. And I think there's a good child-rearing principle that's there. You know, you get a backache when you're a father and you have to follow this little toddling 8-9-month-old around the house, picking up and moving everything out of his way so that he doesn't get a hold of things that you don't want him to get a hold of. And what we tend to do is we tend to move things out of their reach. And we pick up that vase and put it up on the high shelf. And we pick up this and put this on a high shelf. And you can't usually get everything out of the way. They might manage to find something that's within their reach. But we do that. But wouldn't it be better if we applied the tree principle, where you don't put it out of their reach, but you tell them no, and then when your authority is tested, you do what's necessary to teach them that that object's not worth their attention. It's amazing how quickly a 7-8-month-old child can associate or equate pain with no. And obviously trying to teach them how to, what we're trying to teach them that is to teach them how to say no to themselves eventually, where they will, where we could just, they know the difference in what they're allowed to touch and what they're not. And there's certainly far more serious situations ahead that they need to say no to than just touching a plant or some type of ornament. There's examples in the Bible where that worked very well, where God's laws, His word that prohibited some things, worked out very well. Daniel's a great example. God had said in His law to Moses, know about some prohibited foods or things you just couldn't eat. And certainly, Daniel was a young man, and when he was taken away into captivity into Babylon, he was offered by the king all these great foods that he could partake of. And he had no father present to swat his hand and tell him no. The law says no, but he, it said, kept himself pure, and he didn't partake of the foods that the king offered him. And then Joseph's a great example. He knew how to say no to Potiphar's wife, didn't he? He didn't have his dad nearby to raise his eyebrow at him when the woman was making all her advances to him. But he said, how can I do this terrible thing and sin against God? And so he said no to himself. And then there was another example of someone who didn't do so well. His name was Uzzah. Remember Uzzah? He was the one who walked beside the ark when David wanted to have the Ark of the Covenant moved to Jerusalem, and they had it on the cart, and they were transporting it, and the ark tips, the cart tips over, the ark falls, and Uzzah stabilizes it with his hand, and God kills him right on the spot. Well, the law clearly said how that ark should have been transported, and David had already violated that, but Uzzah should have never touched that ark. But he didn't say no to himself. He reached out and touched what was prohibited, and he died for that. So, that's a good principle, the tree principle. Now, God made the rules clear. I think that was interesting, too, is that they were always the same. He didn't change them every day. It would have been kind of frustrating to Adam if he didn't know if the rules were only for Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday and not for Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Does he want me to touch it or not? There was a consistency. But there was this principle that taught him to say no to himself. And I think that's a good child-rearing principle for us to implement. There's a second principle, too, the manna principle. Look, if you would, in Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy chapter 8. This is a principle about learning contentment. It's about learning contentment. When God brought Israel out of the Egyptian bondage and into the wilderness, this is what he did. Chapter 8, verse 1, 2, and 3. All the commandments that I am commanding you today, you shall be careful to do, and that you may live and multiply and go on and possess the land which the Lord swore to give your fathers. And you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let you be hungry, and fed you with manna which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. This was learning. It was a training session. It wasn't inborn in them, but that God trained them that man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that comes out of the mouth of God. And so he taught them to wait on him, taught them to wait and trust in him, that he would provide for them what they really couldn't provide for themselves, this in the wilderness, the food that they needed. And if you're going to create this security, in order to effectively teach contentment, Israel needed to feel secure that his needs would always be met. And God promised them that he would give them manna. He didn't give them manna on Monday, but forget to give it to them on Tuesday, and give it to them on Wednesday, but forget to give it to them on Thursday. He was always consistent. And even when he said that you couldn't gather the manna on the Sabbath, he let them get a double portion on Friday. So they always knew. They had the security that God would take care of their needs. And that was a training session. And they weren't always content with that. Look over, if you would, to Numbers chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11. Verses 4 through 6. It was a point at which in the wilderness the sons of Israel became discontent with what God was giving them. So let's read verse 4 through 6. And the rabble who were among them had greedy desires, and also the sons of Israel wept again. And they said, "Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, and the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our appetite is gone, and there's nothing to look at except this manna." Doesn't that translate really well into what happens at home sometimes? Then look over down a little bit further, verse 18 through 20. So God hears this complaining, and he communicates to Moses, and he says, "Say to this people, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the ears of the Lord, saying, 'Oh, that someone would give us meat to eat, for we were well off in Egypt.' Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat." Well, that sounds like good news. Sounds like they got what they were hoping for. They complained and griped, and so God said, "Fine, okay, I'll give it to you." Let's read on, verse 19 and 20. "And you shall eat, not one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before him, saying, 'Why did we ever leave Egypt?'" And then there's some more things that goes on. Moses can't figure out how he's going to pull that off. He says there's 600,000 of them, and God says, "That's not a problem for me. Who do you think I am? I can do this." But then when he gets down in verse 32 and 33, it says, "And the people," this is after he does give them this quail or this meat, and it's over 2 cubits deep all over the ground. And it says the people spent all day and all night and all the next day and gathered the quail. He who gathered least gathers 10 homers, and they spread them out for themselves all over the camp. While the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against these people, and the Lord struck the people with a very severe plague. Because they're very greedy. They didn't just gather what they needed. They gathered more than what they should have gotten. Well, you know, when they named it, when people started calling it manna, which means, what is it? You know there's trouble coming. I mean, when the kids come to the table and mom's prepared a meal and they look at what's on the table and they say, "What's that?" You know that there's nothing good that's going to come after that. And if they, you know, if God was trying to teach them a lesson, he didn't have to just give them manna at the beginning. But he was trying to teach them something, that he would always take care of their needs and provide them what they needed. And if they would learn to trust him each day, then they wouldn't feel the need to turn to other gods when they went into the land of Canaan. Well, there were many gods in Canaan, and gods of fertility, and people offered sacrifices to these gods to ensure that they would have all that they needed. But God was teaching them and training them that I will always give you what you need, but you need to be content with what I give you. And he worked for 40 years to try to teach him that. Child rearing, the manna principle. Very valuable. You know, it's kind of sad when a mom can't fix one dish for the family to eat because she has prepares special dishes for the kids, because they won't eat what she prepares for the adults. And we do, when we do that, is we teach our children to be discontent, right? And it's, you know, it's kind of hard in our culture to overcome that, because we eat out so much that we just about get whatever we want. So it's not surprising when we get home and we prepare food for somebody and they say, "Well, I want pizza." Another one says, "I want a hamburger." Because we are kind of a cafeteria-style people. We get whatever we want usually. And when they were discontent, what I want you to notice in Numbers, at least chapter 11 is that they were punished. God didn't allow that. His kids weren't too good to eat manna, even if it was 5 nights in a row. And we should ask ourselves, well, are our kids too good to eat manna for 5 nights in a row, if that's what we fix? But he was training them for much greater things. It wasn't just about food. He was training them in this contentment for far greater things. Let's look at a couple of examples in the New Testament for their economic situation. Sometimes it's bad in that they needed to learn to be content in what they situation they were born into. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 6 through 8. There are a lot of slaves that were converted in the New Testament and became Christians, but they were still slaves, and there was no change in their status. They still were slaves. And in chapter 6, 1 Timothy, it says, "Let all who are under the yoke as slaves regard their masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and our doctrine will not be spoken against. Those who have believers as their masters, do not be disrespectful to them because they're brethren." Here's servants who remain servants. They were still slaves when they became Christians. But I notice what he advises them down in verse 6, that godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. "For we have brought nothing into the world, we can't take anything out of it either. And if we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and the snare, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction." So, he's heading off this passion to for more gain, to become wealthy, and by emphasizing the need to be content with what you have. You know, that we only have what God's given us, and we need to be content with that. But also, you know, contentment is applicable when it comes to suffering for the sake of the gospel. First, in Philippians chapter 4, Paul was obviously did a lot of work as an evangelist in different places, and so he had various experiences, and what he learned through that was about how to be content in whatever situation that he was in. Verse 11, he says, "Not that I speak from want or have learned, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am in. I know how to get along with humble means. I know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need." Again, it's a learned sort of thing. But he learned to be content in whatever circumstances he was in. And so you have various applications that we can see maybe in teaching children to be content so that they're able to be content as they grow up in whatever circumstances they have in life. Even in the roles in the family, I think there's an application to be made. I think I would venture to say that one of the hardest roles that you might have is for the woman who's given the role to be this, submissive in the family. To accept that role of submission in the marriage, she's not the principal breadwinner. She sort of entrusts herself to her husband, to go wherever he goes, to follow his lead, where he decides to go and direct the family and spiritual things. And men don't always do a good job of that. And they are left to trust a lot and be content in their circumstances. Abraham drugged Sarah all over to Canaan, and he didn't always take good care of her. Left her in the household of two kings. At different periods of time. But she was praised, actually, I'd never thought about this, but she was praised in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 6 and 7, because she was submissive to her husband in all these circumstances. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 6 and 7, in that chapter where he was teaching wives to be submissive, he says, "Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children if you do what is right without being frightened by any fear." Now, how difficult sometimes that could be to learn contentment under those circumstances. Now, I think that's probably one reason God holds men more responsible in the family, is because he gave women a role where they have to learn to trust their husbands and their care for them. But they have to be content in the circumstances that they're dealt. We're teaching contentment, not merely at the table for what we eat, but for much greater things in life that's before us. Then there's another principle that I want to suggest, and that's the cloud principle. Look back to Numbers chapter 9. Numbers chapter 9. This is verse 15 through 23. It says, this is about when the tabernacle was erected for Israel. On the day that the tabernacle was erected, the cloud covered the tabernacle. And the tent of the testimony, and in the evening, it was like the appearance of fire over the tabernacle until morning. So it was continuously. The cloud would cover it up, cover it by day, and the appearance of fire by night. And whenever the cloud was lifted from over the tent, afterward the sons of Israel would then set out. And the place where the cloud settled down, there the sons of Israel would camp. At the command of the Lord, the sons of Israel would set out. And at the command of the Lord, they would camp. As long as the cloud settled over the tabernacle, they remained camped. And even when the cloud lingered over the tabernacle for many days, the sons of Israel would keep the Lord's charge and not set out. If sometimes the cloud remained a few days over the tabernacle, according to the command of the Lord, they remained camped. Then, according to the command of the Lord, they set out. If sometimes the cloud remained from evening until morning, when the cloud was lifted in the morning, they would move out. Or if it remained in the daytime and at night, whenever the cloud was lifted, they would set out. Whether it was 2 days or a month or a year that the cloud lingered over the tabernacle, staying above it, the sons of Israel remained camped and did not set out. But when it was lifted, they did set out. And at the command of the Lord, they camped. And at the command of the Lord, they set out. And they kept the Lord's charge according to the command of the Lord through Moses. I think it goes without saying what was being emphasized in that passage. In fact, they emphasized it even to the point of being redundant. Okay, we've got the point. Why do you need to say it in 10 verses over and over again? When it moved, they moved. When it stopped, they stopped. And at times it was for long periods, at other times it was very short periods. But no less than 10 times, it says they followed the Lord's directions faithfully. These are training sessions, and they became very important for Israel to learn how not to run ahead of God, but to stay and to obey His word. Look at what just one example of that, Joshua chapter 3 and verse 4. When they went into the land of Canaan, and they were about to go to conquer the city of Jericho, they were to get, everybody was prepared. The Ark of the Covenant went out in the front, and they were prepared to go forward. But Joshua gives them this instruction. He says, however, let's read verse 3 too. He said, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God with the Levitical priest carrying it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. However, there shall be between you and it a distance of about 2,000 cubits by measure, which is about a half a mile. Do not come near it, that you may know the way by which you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. And what they said was, don't run ahead of God. You've never done this before. And so at least in this particular case, waiting for the Lord to do things in His own way was very hard. I mean, they had to wait for the Lord and only go stay back, you know, and let Him take the lead in things. And people were to keep a safe distance because to pass by Him was dangerous. That's a good principle, especially in training young children. The ability to learn to remain, to stay in place, to not set out, or to go whenever the parent says go, or maybe to keep quiet when the parent says keep quiet. We don't wait till the dangerous situation to teach the child when you say stop, that means stop. I mean, the wrong time to start that training process is when one is running for the road, and you want them to stop before they go out in front of a car, or right when they're standing at the edge of the stairs, and they start to take that step, and you say stop. And then it's too late because they never learned that lesson. But this process of training to respond to the commands of the father or the mother, to listen to the Lord and to not move until He moves, until He says move, is a valuable training principle. One suggestion was even in the training of children in worship services to be quiet, or the time period when they're to behave in worship services. That's something that every parent faces, that challenge. And the suggestion was, don't wait till the midst of worship to start training them to do that. There's not very much worship possible for the parent when they have to run in and out with the child every 10 minutes. And this is the suggestion that was in the article, train the child at 1 year old to sit on the person on your lap at home and sit there and be still for 5 minutes. And if he tries to get down or speak, maybe a tap on the mouth or a soft, quiet, you know, be quiet is a part of the training. And if he has a strong will, you administer more persuasive warnings to him. And you do that 2 times a day, increasing it incrementally until you're building up to 15 minutes. It was just a suggestion. I thought it was an interesting application, this idea of how you train and you prepare them to know how to sit still and to be quiet and when to go and when not to go, and that's a training process. And that principle is very important spiritually, more than just at church services or something, but this idea to remain and be still or to wait and go ahead, that applies very much in our spiritual lives as they grow up. Abraham and Sarah, it's a great example. They did really well for 25 years as they were in Canaan. They waited for God to fulfill his promise for Isaac. But there was a point when they got tired of waiting, and they sort of took matters into their own hands. And that made for a very terrible situation for them for the next 13 years as they had Ishmael to deal with and with Hagar. Saul made a terrible mistake. He waited for 7 days in 1 Samuel chapter 13, I think, for Samuel to arrive and offer the sacrifice before the battle. But when he didn't arrive to make the sacrifice, he took matters into his own hands. He didn't wait for that to be followed. And as a result of that, he lost the whole kingdom. God said, I'm taking you out. You're not a king anymore because you didn't learn how to follow my instructions and wait for me. Israel was told to go up and conquer the land after they arrived there, but they didn't do what they were told. They said, well, there's giants in the land. We just can't do this. Impossible. And the Lord said, okay, then you can go back in the wilderness and die. So they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years and died, and he raised up another generation. So let's try it again. But the idea was they did not go up when the Lord said go up. They didn't trust him and obey him. And then there's some good examples on the other hand. I'll just give you one for time's sake, and that's David. That habitually, David, every time he went to a battle, every time, he would ask the Lord, will you give me this people? Will you give them into my hands? And when the Lord said, go up, I'll give them to you, then David took it. But he didn't take a step without instruction from the Lord. And God always gave him victory as he listened to him. So the cloud principle has within it an application that can be useful as we train children. And then the last one I want to suggest is the blessing principle. And I put Deuteronomy 28, you can look there, but it really starts in Genesis chapter 2. Whenever God, going back to the tree, when God created the garden and put man in it, he planted a garden, he placed man in it, and out of the ground God caused to grow one tree that was pleasing to the sight. And the rest were really kind of ugly and didn't taste good. He said, he caused to grow every tree that is pleasing to the sight and good for food. And the tree of life also was in the midst of the garden. God didn't just give us, man, one tree or one fish or one river. He blessed them abundantly. He poured out his blessings on his children. It's kind of like, you know, these were his children. They were made in his image, and he wanted to bless them. And he did the same thing with the children of Israel. And if you're in Deuteronomy chapter 28, which was a chapter that has the blessings and the curses of the covenant, the first half of that chapter is really good. I mean, it's very encouraging. He says to his children, now it shall be, if you will diligently obey the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, which I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come upon you and shall overtake you if you will obey the Lord. Verse 3 says, blessed you shall you be in the city, and blessed shall you be in the country. Blessed shall be the offspring of your body, and the produce of your ground, and the produce of your beasts, and the increase of your herd, and the young of your flock. There's fertility. Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed when you go out. The Lord will cause your enemies who rise up against you to be defeated before you. They shall come out against you one way and flee before you in 7 ways. The Lord will command the blessing upon you in your barns and in all that you put your hand to. He will bless you in the land which the Lord God gives you. The Lord will establish you as a holy people to Himself, as He swore to you, if you will keep the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in His ways. So all the peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you. And the Lord will make you abound in prosperity, in the offspring of your body, and in the offspring of your beast, and in the produce of your ground, and in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers to give you. And we could read more, but I'll stop for time's sake. But all the way down through verse 14, he just lists all of these abundant blessings he wants to give to them. I mean, this would be very important if you want to know what kind of God that you've got, and what you can expect of Him. And as they responded positively to His training sessions, then they were praised, there were blessings, there were rewards, there were abundance. As a father who wanted to dote on his children, he wanted to bless them with things. And God, you know, God wins our hearts. He wins His children's hearts by, and their respect, by His love, not by threats and discipline. That's not how He wins our hearts. How many Psalms could we read where it says, give thanks to the Lord, for He is good. His loving kindness is everlasting. And He still does that today. He loved us so much that He did what? That He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever would believe in Him would not perish, but have eternal life. We have redemption through His blood, Paul said in Ephesians, the forgiveness of our sins, according to the riches of His grace, which He lavished upon us. So here's a God who blesses. He wants to extend His mercy and His grace to us. He sent Jesus as our mediator to listen to us. And He says, cast all your cares upon Him, for He cares for you, in 1 Peter chapter 5. And the point being is, as His children, we get a sense that we are important. That we are, He cares for us, and He wants to bless us. And that's an important parenting principle, isn't it? That as children respond well to training, we need to pour out our love. It was not counterproductive to be kind and to bless children, to be patient with them, to praise them, to win their hearts with loving expressions. Their blessings aren't their rights. That's part of the problem, is that children think their blessings are their rights. They, and the children of Israel, their blessings were revoked when they would not be trained. But that's not the rule. That's what God wanted to do, was to bless them. And so here's another blessing principle that I think has some great application. As we see God training His children in the Old Testament. You probably can think of a dozen more good examples that would work out in this lesson. But for the sake of time, there's four things that would be that I found was interesting in sure you could come up with a lot more. Well, if you want to get your psalm books and turn to the psalm that was selected, number 310, Why Keep Jesus Waiting? Certainly it wasn't a lesson about becoming a Christian, but we see a loving Father, a God who wants to bless, who calls and is waiting for us to come to Him. And this morning we would encourage you to make a decision to follow after Him, to believe in Jesus, be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins, to turn and make Him your Lord, and to receive the abundance of blessings that comes through that. Can we invite you to do that? Make that decision today while you have an opportunity. And if you would let us help you with that, we will, while we stand and sing.